Welcome, everyone, to the Friday night public discussion group of Perfecting Horizons Institute. We are in paper 74, section 8, which is old single column, page 836. Okay, this final section of this paper where they alluded to it as we were in the earlier part of the paper. They give us a little aside, a step aside from the recounting the historical story of Adam and Eve and the Garden of Eden, and address mainly the issue of the creation stories that are at the beginning of the Old Testament, at the beginning of the book of Genesis. Remember how we saw that there actually was day one, day two, day three, day four, day five, day six. So that obviously fed into the mythology, the mythological story that's in the first chapter of Genesis, about creation occurring over the span of 6 days. So they want to address that primary issue, but they'll give us a number of related issues at the same time, obviously, as they always do. They always use every opportunity, even in the midst of them taking an opportunity to take an aside. They'll take an aside in the aside. They're always looking for a context to give you, every detail that they're allowed to give us. And that's why, if you want the whole sense of what they give you on a certain topic in the Revelation, you can't just go to, maybe there's a section, with that title. And you think, okay, it's all right here. It's like, no, it's never all there in one section, even if that section has that heading. Very important details are scattered all over. It might even be just a parenthetical phrase in some sentence in some part of the book. You wouldn't even imagine it's going to say something about that, but there's a context there, and they slip it in. So, you have to try to achieve a very holistic relationship with the text before you can have the information required to do a proper synthesis. Right? You analyze the book, you get all the parts, but then the point is to not just sit there on the sum of those parts, but to supersummatively go up to a synthesis, go up to the whole. The whole that is the context for all those parts. And why would you want to do that? Because only when you do that can you possibly have any relationship to truth. Truth is not to be found in any part, as they make very clear in the book. Truth is fundamentally a word talking about that synthetic whole. The word logic is also about that synthetic whole. Philosophy is about that synthetic whole. Let's see what little tidbits they can give us here. About elements in our myth in Genesis that actually do have some tie to the facts of history.
Section 8, the legend of creation. The story of the creation of Urantia in 6 days was based on the tradition that Adam and Eve had spent just 6 days in their initial survey of the garden. This circumstance lent almost sacred sanction to the time period of the week, which had originally been introduced by the Dalmatians. Adam's spending 6 days inspecting the garden and formulating preliminary plans for organization was not prearranged. It was worked out from day to day. The choosing of the seventh day for worship was wholly incidental to the facts herewith narrated.
Okay, so just a simple statement, but very illuminating about a number of elements in the basic way we structure ourselves. The fact that the seven-day week was set up by the prince's staff, that was actually enough of a profound fact that everyone was dutifully counting 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 for hundreds of thousands of years. But they're pointing out that it took on even more, as they're pointing out, of a sacred-like nature when you bring in Adam and Eve and their influence. Like we saw, it's not the prince's staff that led to the art element of halos. It's Adam and Eve that led to the art element of halos. And I see, so there's that religiosity, if you will, to it that they bring to bear. So we still, we very quote unquote religiously count 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 to this day. And that seventh day, end up being, one of the Ten Commandments from Moses, remembering the Sabbath day to keep it holy. It turned into the Sabbath day because there was that upheaval, and Adam, in response to it, said, everyone just, chill out and worship, and don't worship me. That's how it got started. If there hadn't been that upheaval, we never would have ended up with a Sabbath day. Isn't that, an interesting little tidbit? It just would have been another day of the week. I'm sure we would have picked, someday to be Sunday, quote unquote, someday, to be a special day. But we already see we got, you modified it from the seventh day to the first day when you brought in Christianity. And we still have people, thinking that no, it's you're supposed to worship on the seventh day, not the first day. As they treat it as a serious, quote unquote, religious element. Okay, so there's all those details. And then you've also got the, that I think I mentioned that back then, that there was nothing planned about that. It just happened that way. Even though the 7 days were in place, it's not like Adam or the Melchizedeks or anyone said, well, let's just set aside the first week. No one was thinking that way. It just kind of ended up being. The whole point is how something that, has in many ways an arbitrary origin ends up being so definitive and taken so seriously. It's just the way we are about things. All right. Anything else we have there?
Give us an inch and we'll take a week.
I think that's probably enough we said about that. Okay, so that's the key element, and they've got just a few other little elements that they want to point out, and then they actually start getting into a lot of the. Well, as long as we're talking about things in this area, let's mention a few other things. Let's see what they have to say about Genesis here first.
The legend of the making of the world in 6 days was an afterthought. In fact, more than 30,000 years afterwards.
Now that's an afterthought.
One feature of the narrative, the sudden appearance of the sun and moon, may have taken origin in the traditions of the one-time sudden emergence of the world from a dense space cloud of minute matter which had long obscured both sun and moon.
Whoa! Like I say, out of the blue comes this totally amazing little comment.
I think people would freak out. I think they're dealing with global warming. Yeah.
You think we have issues with quote unquote climate change now? Okay. So, but first of all. You know that more than 30,000 years afterward, remember how this works. You know, we've got them, way back there, and they arrived in 35,915 BC, right? And you don't have recorded history until 6,000, 5,000 BC, right? So. But even that, you don't actually have, as I'll get to here in a little bit, you don't have what's in the Old Testament being written down in its basically current form until the exile in Babylon during the 6th century BC. So in that sense of getting actually to the story that we basically read today, it's even a little longer. But that's what they're doing there, is they're just kind of saying that you take things forward to kind of what your immediate oral tradition beginnings are, the beginnings of recorded history.
So before we go on to this.
Mm-hmm.
You think, because I started looking at an alphabet during the times of Dalmatia.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you've got Adam and Eve's
reintroducing an alphabet. Yeah.
Right.
Yep.
There was still no writing though.
Except for like those stones, that you could, if you knew where to look in the Persian Gulf, obviously if they're writing on something besides a stone, carving it deep into a stone, it's going to, it's long gone. It's hard to even keep papyruses, for very long.
In terms of traditionally keeping something at least with animals.
Just one little aside here. I'll do like they do, making a little aside about climate issues. Another thing you should remember about them, mentioning a climate thing. We have a very biased notion about the uniformity of the climate because we live in these last few thousand years. I mean, one of the main reasons why recorded history begins about 6,500 to 5,000 BC is because before then, every say 1,000 years or so, there would be radical climate change, and the whole habitable locations would be rearranged on the planet. What used to be a great place to live is now a desert, and vice versa, and so things were coincidentally. As you needed to get civilization stabilized, there's kind of a lull in the variability of the climate of the planet. We talked about how they tell you that's not a coincidence. The evolution, physical evolution of the system that we're in, is synchronized through the presence of the Supreme with the human evolution. And so, don't be surprised if once humans have the scientific ability to deal with a more variable climate, coincidentally, the climate is going to be more variable again. But see, that's one of the reasons, it's sort of like every 1,000 years or so, there was a giant eraser taken to everything, to history, and we lost it all because there was just such a traumatic upsetting of the stability of civilization. That's why we tended to lose so much. The only place that, held on to a little bit is there in Mesopotamia.
Where was the last ice age?
Through the Sumerians. Well, it's basically coming to an end except in the polar regions 35,000 years ago. Yeah. But it started 2 million years ago. Okay, so now to their fascinating little tidbit here. Okay, so first of all, if you don't remember the 6-day story in the first chapter of Genesis, You know, you start out, you get separate the light and the darkness, and you get the waters above and the waters below, and you know, and you get the plants going and everything. And then all of a sudden, out of the blue, in on day four, you get the sun and the moon and the stars formed. And you're going, like, well, how if I didn't have the sun and the moon, how did I have day and night, you know, what they said before? It's a curious thing that a ways into the story, you suddenly have the sun and the moon making their appearance. That's what they're referring to here. Is the reason that it seems to be kind of out of place, because, you know, it's a little remembrance of, you know, we've been around for a long time, but eventually the sun kind of was shining more brightly again, and it hadn't been for a long time, the sun and the moon.
Is that dense thing something that can happen anytime?
Can happen anytime, that the solar system might, you know, stumble upon a lot of gas and dust in the disk of the Milky Way. Yep.
Just go outside in L.A.
But you know, it's very interesting then for them to say that. Yeah, cool. You notice they don't give you any very precise details, because I'm sure they couldn't. But they're telling you that if you look back and, you know, as you try to sleuth historical climate, you know, sort of pre-recorded history climate, like we love to do these days, we're constantly trying to find, you know, ways of sleuthing what it was way back when. They're telling you that there was some extended period of time in the last million years, right? And we're talking about humans remembering this, right? See, they're saying that humans have some memory of it suddenly, you know, getting brighter. We don't know how long it was in this dimmed state, but we do know in the last million years it cleared up, so that humans are remembering it.
Why would it be a sudden emergence too?
Well, you know, you just get to the edge. No, it doesn't blow away. You just get to the, you know, you have a big cloud of gas and dust in the disk of the Milky Way galaxy, and our solar system moves into it, you know, and at some point you move out of it. Sky clears, you know, as it were. But really, that's the interesting thing for the scientists to sleuth about, try to figure out. But the fact that they're telling you, I mean, humans have wondered about this. I mean, they've even wondered if this had anything to do with the Ice Age, right? I mean, this is one of the things that people have wondered about, you know, about the Ice Age. But, we know the basic details from the Urantia Book of why the Ice Age occurred. But interestingly, one of those speculations, we have been in a time. So, you know, think about the huge climate impact, right? I mean, you diminish the solar input to the Earth just a tiny bit, and it has a huge consequence on the Earth. You know, whether it's the variation in the sun itself, which it does vary, you know, and could, you know, next year the sun could decide to be to give off a little less light and it'd get a lot cooler on this planet, no matter what humans do, you know, or vice versa. That's just a very interesting little scientific hint that they throw in there. However, the one little fascinating historical thing is, may have taken origin in the traditions. The author here, you know, Solonia, actually doesn't know for certain, you know, what all went into the mythology. You know, it reminds you that things were pretty unsettled for a long time in terms of the celestial inhabitants of this world as well. You know, you wonder if they have issues with some of their records. Normally, you know, you would have all kinds of very precise details of exactly what all went on, and, you know, who talked to whom and about what, and, you know, and the whole history of the mortals on that world. But I'm always struck occasionally when they make a qualified statement like that, you know, that seems to indicate, you know, a lack of total certitude on their, you know, on the author's part about something that happened in history. It's like, you know, like, weren't the life carriers or whoever there? Don't you have records of all this? You know, apparently there's some some fuzziness. But anyway, so that's that, you know, that's often puzzled anyone with any kind of a, you know, a scientific mind or whatever. You're reading Genesis story and you're going, huh, that's weird. Why would they put the sun and the moon thing, you know, way in? Why isn't that on the first day when you've got day and night? So anyway. All right, now, before we go to the next little paragraph here, if people aren't familiar, I said it up front, you know, I said the creation stories. So there actually are two creation stories in Genesis. You have the first story, the, you know, days 1 through 6 story, in the first chapter of Genesis. And then, kind of interestingly, there's the little epilogue of that story is that the first few verses of the second chapter of Genesis, the day 7 part of the story, which is kind of interesting. See, you know, what they're telling you here. I mean, there really is a 6-day story. And we actually have that in the Bible, that we divide the first story of the first 6 days, and then the 7th day is kind of this afterthought, like it is here, as they're mentioning. You know, Adam and Eve didn't do something for 7 days, they did something for 6 days, and then the 7th day thing was an afterthought event, you know, if you will, the upheaval. So that's interesting, even the way Genesis is broken up into chapters. But after that little tail ends of the first story at the beginning of the second chapter, then you suddenly seem to start all over again with a new story. And that's the story where you get Eve, you know, and that, those things, and you begin to talk about the garden. And, you know, there's always been a lot of confusion about, you know, what's the deal? Why is there seem to be two stories here? Why isn't it all just one contiguous story? You know, they're going to give us some hints about that as we read forward. But the next couple things that they talk about are from the second story. So first of all, they give us this.
The story of creating Eve out of Adam's rib is a confused condensation of the Adamic arrival and the celestial surgery connected with the interchange of living substances associated with the coming of the corporeal staff of the planetary prince more than 450,000 years previously.
Okay, so, yeah, like I just said, I mean, there is no Eve in the first story. So obviously, this is in the second story. If you've got Eve, that's where the whole rib thing is. And, you know, sometimes a translation might even say part instead of rib, you know, just not be so seemingly curiously specific about it, you know, which would feed into what they're saying. Yeah, I mean, they took parts from the Andonites, right, to make the bodies for the prince's staff. You know, so they're pointing out that, see, there's a vague memory of that. It's like, well, how could there be? It was so long ago. Remember, there's Nonites, right? The Nonites are carrying those stories forward. Right, and so they feed in through the Nonites. We get little snippets of stuff that goes all the way back. You know, and that gets blended in to the mythology that is, you know, first and foremost stemming from the fact of Adam and Eve. But little snippets of Dalmatia get blended in. And that's, you know, they're saying that's actually what happened there. Yeah, right. I mean, and you know, But in terms of the sort of organic mythological phenomenon, right? I mean, that would be the Nonites. I mean, exactly what influence Dan and Abaddon had on these things, you know? They have kind of more of a revelatory influence, I guess, you know. But
no, the Avalon surgeons are impressive. They don't just go away when.
Mm-hmm.
Impressed with.
I just think it's kind of amazing to us that these oral traditions can go on for thousands of years.
Yeah.
But we're so used to thinking, oh, what's the newest, the latest, and the greatest?
Yeah.
They don't have that. Mm-hmm. You know, their memory of their origins and their And looking back is much more important and vivid and engrossing than it would be to us.
Yes, not to mention one of the main differences between that first phase of progressing civilization, the early phase, and the subsequent advancing phase is going from what's basically natural to what's unnatural, what's, you know, a more of a manifestation of the free will exercise of your personality imposed upon the system. And see, it's, it takes conscious use of personality to think about the future, to be a people of the future, to have a future time orientation, right? Naturally, you don't. Naturally, you're more animal-like. You exist in the present, and you have you look back for, you know, sort of the transmoment meaning of things in the past, right? The past is where the value is rather than the future. So, and we're still struggling today to have a handful of people on the planet that are a people of the future, a society with a future time orientation, instead of, you know, everything being just so fixated on, you know, the golden age, you know, in their story of the past.
Right? Yeah. Antiquities and get all the spotlight.
Yeah, and because it's such a minimal, limited number of people that have a future time orientation, right? Those on the planet who are very, very concerned, you know, about what they see as noticing differences in people. You know, they notice that almost everyone on the planet has a past time orientation. And so they literally have concluded that anyone that has a future time orientation is a racist. Right? They're that minority that has some issue with the majority, you know, and denigrates a past time orientation. Right? You know, obviously, you know, the future time orientation is the aberration, you know. That's what you should be looking down upon. You know, see, they flip everything around. I mean, and I'm not joking, literally, you know, quote unquote, if you have a future time orientation, you are a racist. And see, that's a literal biasing away from human consciousness, exalting animal consciousness.
Exalting culture from the past, like keeping tradition going endlessly.
Legacy, tradition, convention.
Like it's a holy thing. Right. To be like backwards, even.
Yeah, yeah. See, so, I mean, that just drives things to everyone to a fundamentalist mentality, a past looking mentality. Yeah, and it's like, no, again, legacy, tradition, convention, that's kind of the story of the early phase of progressing civilization. But like the revelators tell you with the evolution of civilization, you need to flip that into the advancing mode where legacy, tradition, convention are replaced by wisdom, insight, and foresight. Foresight, the people of the future.
Maybe we wouldn't languish in futile.
Yes, yes. Why do you still languish in futile yearning? Yes. Okay, so anyway, we got way off on a tangent there.
I'm totally confused.
but anyway, okay, so back to the rib story. So that's, you know, they're just pointing out, you know, it seems like a really ridiculous, goofy story. Yeah, like they took a rib out and made Eve out of it. They're saying, no, okay, don't think about it so simplistically factually. There's a thread of truth flowing through that story. It ties back to actual facts, right? Not literally, but, right? It's the mythological essence of the making the bodies for the prince's staff. Mm-hmm. And literally taking parts from so another human and to make the body for, you know, a new body for another human. Okay. All right, so yeah, so that's in the second story in the second chapter of Genesis. What else do they have here?
The majority of the world's peoples have been influenced by the tradition that Adam and Eve had physical forms created for them upon their arrival on Urantia. The belief in man's having been created from clay was well nigh universal in the Eastern Hemisphere. This tradition can be traced from the Philippine Islands around the world to Africa. And many groups accepted this story of man's clay origin by some form of special creation in the place of the earlier beliefs in progressive creation, evolution.
Yeah, so they'll come back to the evolution issue again if you're not familiar with that. We forgot about evolution and had to rediscover it. You know, everyone used to know that it was that, you know, we were an evolutionary phenomenon, and that got lost. It had to be rediscovered by, you know, Darwin and crew. Right, that again, that telling the story about Adam being formed, you know, from the dust of the earth, from, you know, from clay, you know, that's again in the second, you know, creation story. And did you notice the pun in there towards the end? The many groups accepted this story of man's clay origin by some form of special creation. They couldn't. Solonia couldn't. See, not even Solonia can resist a good pun. Yes. And, you know, that's the word that's used. You know, you're forming it like you form clay, right? Into a pot or whatever, right?
We really are like Play-Doh in their hands.
Or, yes. Or putty, maybe. Let's see. Okay, so, you know, you've got, you know, when you look, see, they're pointing out when scholars look at this and think, well, okay, everybody's got this story. I mean, that's all there is to it. It was just kind of a universal story. But it's like, yeah, well, why is it a universal story? Right? I mean, often things in the Bible will get dismissed as just yet another example of that universal, you know, element in stories. It's like, yeah, but why? What leads to the universality of some of these elements? Right? And they often are pointing that out. It's like, well, there was a big thing called a real Adam and Eve, and it had a huge impact, as they point out. And you really can't fault people for blurring the forming the bodies for the prince's staff with rematerializing Adam and Eve. I mean, you know, how are they going to understand the difference between the two, right? But it has a huge impact when you throw out evolution and think of this special creation, you know, of these initial perfect beings. Well, we're not everything's not perfect now. Well, there was a fall, the fall of man, and it's like, well, you know, how does that? Well, there's original sin. See, all that stuff. All those elements, like the fall of man, original sin, those notions had to be dreamt up to rationalize everything with the false initial assumption that there was this special creation, that it's not an evolutionary phenomenon. So it's, you know, whenever you have a false initial assumption, in order to keep things matched up, you know, you have to bring in at least one other false, you know, notion or assumption to offset, you know, so that two quote-unquote wrongs make a right. You know, I mean, everything works like that. If you assume the nucleus of the atom is composed of literal little billiard balls called protons and neutrons, well, the immediate physics of those would say that the nucleus flies apart and is not stable. But you look at it, it's like, well, the chair I'm sitting in doesn't seem to be falling apart. So there must be a strong force to hold the billiard balls together. See, you know, when you make one false initial assumption, you have to make at least one other companion for it right? To get to offset its false consequences. Because you're actually observing things. You know, this isn't all just in your imagination, this story you're telling. You're comparing it to observation.
Like you always say, it's a false hope.
That's the only evidence of a strong force?
Yeah. There has to be a strong force, because if there wasn't, right, the nucleus would fall apart.
There's no other explanation because...
Yeah. And again, it's like, well, there are, what do you mean, all kinds of experiments demonstrate that appears that there's protons and neutrons in the nucleus. Yeah, okay, but appearance is not reality. Just because it appears that way doesn't mean it really is that way.
Right. So just get confirmation.
You know, I go off on that tangent a lot. That's a very important point. You can't observe reality.
The same thing happens with the 14 billion year old universe we're in. Figuring out ways to try and
If you assume a thing started with a big bang, then it appears that the universe is 13.8 billion years old, or whatever the current number is. But it isn't really. That issue of appearance and reality is always one to keep in mind, and it comes in simple places, like I was just saying. It appears that the clay origin story in the Bible is just yet another version. It goes from the Philippines to Africa, blah blah blah. Right? Everyone's got this notion. So it appears that it's really doesn't point to anything significant, but it really does. You know, it points to a fact in history that was very profound.
I wonder if that ratio of 13.8 billion over 300 trillion is roughly a ratio of hard departure from truth.
Yeah, I mean, we just have, we are so far, like I said, back when we were talking about those issues, right, the difference between 4004 BC for creation and 13.8 or, let's be super generous. Let's say it's 20 billion. I mean, right, the difference is a difference of no consequence compared to the actual age of the finite domain. Back to the story here. Like I said, they're going to give us a little bit more on that. That evolution notion as they talk forward here. So let's keep going here.
Away from the influences of Dalmatia and Eden, mankind tended toward the belief in the gradual ascent of the human race. The fact of evolution is not a modern discovery. The ancients understood the slow and evolutionary character of human progress. The early Greeks had clear ideas of this despite their proximity to Mesopotamia. Although the various races of Earth became sadly mixed up in their notions of evolution, nevertheless, many of the primitive tribes believed and taught that they were the descendants of various animals. Primitive peoples made a practice of selecting for their totems the animals of their supposed ancestry. Certain North American Indian tribes believed they originated from beavers and coyotes. Certain African tribes teach that they are descended from the hyena, a Malay tribe from the lemur, a New Guinea group from the parrot.
You gotta love the Malay tribe from the lemur. You're going, oh! It does go back to a lemur type. And when we get farther along in the book, we'll eventually get to the discussions about fetishism and totemism, in particular, that they're bringing up here, but they're giving you this little tease up front about that you might not have appreciated, that isn't just some curious belief, that's based upon the recognition that. Everything is an evolutionary phenomenon, and that the current stuff are the products of an evolutionary process, and that humans go back to animals, and those animals go back to more primitive animals, and that was basically understood. And they mentioned the early Greeks. If you go back to the 6th century BC, when you had the awakening of philosophy in Greece, you can find some of those very first individuals that we call the first philosophers talking about evolution. Okay, I mean, obviously it's going to be a relatively primitive scientific explanation, right, of evolution, but it's evolution nonetheless. It's not the fiat creation thing, the special creation thing. So that even though they were close to Mesopotamia, the source of this false notion, they were carrying forward enough of the memory of what actually happened, through their Andite inheritance, their Andite ancestors, back to Adamson and Rada and such issues, right, that would have taught about, the proper origin of the human race, so that didn't get totally lost, but it was kind of kept apart from Mesopotamia, but then moved back into close proximity to Mesopotamia and didn't get corrupted because of it. Let's see, what else do we have there? I guess that's the basics of it there. For those of you who've taken Reawakening Philosophy 1, you may even remember that we mentioned that in passing as we're going through those initial philosophers in the 6th century BC, that issue of them thinking in terms of evolution. All right, keep going here.
The Babylonians, because of immediate contact with the remnants of the civilization of the Adamites, enlarged and embellished the story of man's creation. They taught that he had descended directly from the gods. They held to an aristocratic origin for the race, which was incompatible with even the doctrine of creation out of clay.
And you see that, if you look in that, what we have of some of the earliest recorded history there coming out of Mesopotamia, not surprisingly, right, like say if you look at the Sumerian kings list, right, you look at it and go, oh, okay, so basically they're saying Adam and Eve, even though they don't say that, right, the first ones come down from heaven, and all the kings are descended from those ones that came down from heaven. So like they're pointing out, and the fact that the Sumerians, are the nugget of significant civilization that is there at the beginning of recorded history, right? Their stories had a huge influence on all of the eventual Western civilization that stems from that nucleus. Okay, but what about, so in other words, you can tell, from what they're saying there, that first creation story does get a lot of, has some influence from the Babylonians. Remember, it's, things are finally being written down during the exile in Babylon during the 6th century BC and stuff. But, you can notice there's this very curious change in how the story is told when you go to the second creation story. What's the deal with that? That's what they bring up here next.
The Old Testament account of creation dates from long after the time of Moses. He never taught the Hebrews such a distorted story. But he did present a simple and condensed narrative of creation to the Israelites, hoping thereby to augment his appeal to worship the Creator, the Universal Father, whom he called the Lord God of Israel.
See, the thing that you notice You know, if you just take an initial kind of scholarly-like look at those two creation stories, all of a sudden, out of the blue, as soon as you get to the second creation story, the very first time they mention God, the word there is Yahweh, where it wasn't before. You know, like at the beginning of the first creation story, I mean, it's literally in, the spirit of the Trinity, moved over the waters. In the beginning, the Trinity created the heavens and the earth. You have that Elohim, which is the actual memory coming through these higher peoples, like they were just saying, of teachings about the Trinity and stuff. Right, but you get to Moses' little synopsis story. See, and there isn't all the details, like the sixth day, all that complexity stuff. You know, he just gives this quick little synopsis, and then he gets to the Garden of Eden and stuff, right? Like they're saying there. See, that actually is Moses' stuff, and it is, he's saying Yahweh. And so that's the deal. And you kind of can feel that. It's sort of, from the second story forward, it seems like a kind of a uniform telling of a tale, and that the first creation story is just this thing that's kind of glued onto the front, and that's literally what it is. It's a non quote unquote Moses story, if you will, that's glued onto the beginning, and it's not a Yahweh story of God. The Lord God of Israel, of course, is Yahweh. As I've already pointed out, Moses is, way, way, way back there, and you aren't literally writing this up down in kind of its final form until the 6th century B.C. So, the Old Testament account of creation dates from long after the time of Moses. Okay.
When was Moses?
We'll get to some just a second. They're going to mention that. The scholars that a lot of scholars don't think Moses was ever a real person, but those that do are confused about when he lived. There's a lot of speculation. You'll see they actually give us a little hint here.
In his early teachings, Moses very wisely did not attempt to go back of Adam's time. And since Moses was the supreme teacher of the Hebrews, the stories of Adam became intimately associated with those of creation. That the earlier traditions recognized pre-Adamic civilization is clearly shown by the fact that later editors, intending to eradicate all reference to human affairs before Adam's time, neglected to remove the telltale reference to Cain's emigration to the land of Nod, where he took himself a wife.
Yeah, as everyone knows, it's like, well, if Adam and Eve are the first two, heck is Cain marrying? And the way that the Jews have always rationalized that is they leverage off the two creation stories. It's like, well, they don't mention Eve in the first creation story. They don't mention any woman at all. But they always assume, well, there must have been a first wife. Okay, that's Lilith, right? If you've ever heard the name Lilith, right? That's the supposed first wife that's not literally mentioned in the first creation story. And so the assumption is that Adam and Lilith, had a bunch of kids, right? But eventually, and there's all kinds of wild stories and stuff about why he ends up dumping Lilith and bringing Eve into this, God brings Eve into the story. But see, that's the way they rationalize it, that Cain is going to these descendants of Adam and Lilith. But now we know that you don't need to fabricate stories like that. But that is a blow to a lot of people tie their whole identity to Lilith. There was no Lilith. very politically incorrect thing to say, but these days. But anyway, there it is. I think everyone knows that you don't have anything there in the first two chapters of Genesis that you know, other than the little Land of Nod thing, you know, this gives any hint. And so that's why, you know, when Moses starts just trying to explain things forward from Adam, and then you've got this creation story that seems to, you know, to start when there's nothing and God is, you know, making, you know, everything, you know, beyond the earth and everything, why those end up, like they're saying, being thought of as all just, you know, in a very short span of time. You know, if Moses had given some hints of some long span of time prior to Adam and Eve, right, there wouldn't be this assumption that, you know, day one in the first creation story, you know, is literally just, you know, a little time before Adam and Eve are on the scene, right? We would probably have rationalized for a long time that that's talking about some extremely remote time. Maybe everyone would just go, well, you know, I think it's probably the Big Bang, you know, and blah, 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 you know, and we'd think it's 13.8 billion years ago or whatever, instead of 4004 BC. Anyway, so that's you know, see, they're trying to just clear up all that confusion about the two creation stories and how we've rationalized them together and whatnot. All right, anything else there?
Why was wise not to go back?
Because he's trying to, you know, just get his people with a solid footing under them. You know, he's there, you know, as the Revelators point out, there's a truth back then to the chosen people notion. Right? And his job really, you know, in the evolutionary sort of the historical scheme of things, is to see to it that there's some integrity to those people, because eventually there has to be some integrous people that Michael can be born into as Jesus. And, you know, the Melchizedeks we know we're working with them too, trying to keep them and, you know, held together. You know, if he were to bring in, you know, a big picture, you know, it would be hard for them to maintain their self-respect.
Focus.
Yeah, and their focus. So he wisely, you know, just kept it simple. But, you know, the way they said that, he did not attempt to go back of Adam's time. He knew, remember, because Moses is coming down from what Machiavelli and Melchizedek taught the Kenites, right? He taught them a lot of very big picture things. You know, Moses consciously circumscribed his story. He just wasn't, his story isn't circumscribed because he was ignorant. Yeah. Okay. All right, let's keep going here.
The Hebrews had no written language in general usage for a long time after they reached Palestine. They learned the use of an alphabet from the neighboring Philistines, who were political refugees from the higher civilization of Crete. The Hebrews did little writing until about 900 BC, and having no written language until such a late date, they had several different stories of creation in circulation. But after the Babylonian captivity, they inclined more toward accepting a modified Mesopotamian version.
I see. So you just kind of tweak that first story a little bit, like you're saying, a modified Mesopotamian version, so that it, you know, it has Adam, you know, it matches up and with the second story, and that's how they went. But, you know, if you're not familiar with, you know, some of these scholarly issues, if you will, you know, the written, you know, Hebrew language doesn't go back extremely far. Matter of fact, in its, you know, in its basically sort of current form, that was being put together in the 6th century BC there. But some early stuff does go back, you know, a few centuries before that. But, you know, I mean, back in David and Solomon's time, no, not so much. It's kind of sort of in the wake of Solomon that you, they start to become more of a written language people, you know, and things are getting a little bit more sophisticated so that by the time they are in captivity in Babylon, right, they have that that sense of themselves to really focus in and put together a definitive written story about themselves. Again, with the, you know, those that, that put together that story did all kinds of purposeful modifications of the actual historical record because they were trying to really focus in on just shoring up, you know, the waning self-respect of their people. See, a lot like what Moses was doing, trying to mold something with some integrity and some enduring self-respect and not to feel so small in such a big place. And, you know, there ends up being, you know, a bit of over, you know, exaltation, obviously, to do that. But, okay, so, like I said, see, they're going to give us a little bit about those two millennia BC, you know, the time from Machaventa forward. Remember, Machaventa came in 1984 BC. You know, and things are a bit fuzzy. We're kind of confused about exactly when Egyptian things were happening in there. And the revelators give occasional little clues about things in that regard to try to help us sort out especially the second millennium BC stuff that we're kind of confused about. Okay.
Jewish tradition became crystallized about Moses, and because he endeavored to trace the lineage of Abraham back to Adam, the Jews assumed that Adam was the first of all mankind. Yahweh was the creator, and since Adam was supposed to be the first man, he must have made the world just prior to making Adam. And then the tradition of Adam's 6 days got woven into the story, with the result that almost 1,000 years after Moses' sojourn on earth, the tradition of creation in 6 days was written out and subsequently credited to him.
Okay. So, I mean, I already kind of said some of those details in there, see how they rationalized the two creation stories together. And see the little hint there, all right? So, right, this is all getting, you know, written down in the 6th century B.C. and during the exile. So almost 1,000 years after Moses' sojourn on earth. See, so that's putting him in the 15th century B.C., probably. You know, again, they didn't say anything hyper-precise. They probably weren't allowed to. But at least they're giving you a little hint there. You know, he's not, say, in the, you know, the 13th century B.C. or whatever. Like I said, there's lots of speculation about when he might have actually lived. If they, you know, if, you know. But, of course, because of all these mythological elements that they're talking about get woven into supposedly, you know, his hand, you know, his writing. I mean, that's why some scholars just say, the whole thing is just a total myth. There never was a Moses. You know, he's got the classic things of, you know, you float the baby, you know, down the river and he's discovered and a yada, you know, and all of those classic mythological elements. You know, so they just dismiss him totally as a historical figure. Anyway, so that's an interesting little clue about when he lived. All right, keep going here.
When the Jewish priests returned.
Oh, wait, hold on. I just looked down. One other quick little comment. Everyone, I think, knows that, don't they? That, you know, because he, Moses, endeavored to trace the lineage of Abraham back to Adam. You remember, they're literally, that's when you get into the first. So and so begat so and so, and you know whatnot. You know, in the Bible, you know, is starting with Adam and Eve and going forward, and you know, having Methuselah and all that stuff, and Enoch, and you know, walked with God and was no more, sort of, you know, all those sorts of things. You know, that's all in that story, trying to, you know, piece it together going forward from Adam. But it obviously doesn't span going all the way back to the actual arrival of Adam and Eve. If you add up all those, you know, those individuals in that story. So he, you know, it's condensed. All right. Excuse me. Go ahead. Keep going.
When the Jewish priests returned to Jerusalem, they had already completed a writing of their narrative of the beginning of things. Soon they made claims that this recital was a recently discovered story of creation written by Moses. But the contemporary Hebrews of around 500 BC did not consider these writings to be divine revelations. They looked upon them much as later peoples regard mythological narratives.
See, so like I was saying, you get to the end of the 6th century BC, you know, that, you know, you've got the first that have come back from exile during the 6th century there, and you know, the thing about their, you know, they did not consider these writings to be divine revelations. They looked upon them much as later peoples regard mythological narratives. But don't forget that they don't have any sort of a scientific, you know, or fact-based training like we do. You know, so don't superimpose that on them. You know, as you try to imagine how they thought about it. You know, they no one was looking for writings to be quote unquote accurate historical accounts or anything like we, you know, look for. God, I wish I could find a, you know, a biography of John Adams that gave a solid, you know, accurate historical account, you know, with no bias blended in. I mean, you know, they didn't think like that back then. You know, so, you know, in a way, you can give them the full benefit of the doubt and say that without fully understanding what they were doing, they had a tendency to relate to a story more to the truth of the story first, you know, and maybe not really get to the facts at all, which is helpful because factually there's lots of issues with those stories. Right? And we take those stories and we don't know anything about truth, you know, we're hopeless with truth anymore. You know, all we know about is fact, or we try to know about fact, what we think is fact, and we look at this thing, it's like, well, I don't think there's any fact here, so this is a worthless story. Right? You may toss out the whole Bible in that mode. It's like, you know, if you are such a fact-biased mind. And, you know, that's why I always stress, that's going to be your tendency when you engage the Urantia book. And that's a very unfortunate tendency to have, right? Because even though the facts are solid in the book, if you seek first the facts, you can't get to the truth. You know, and all of your interpretations of the facts will be erroneous. So it's actually important to think about how they were not, you know, in an analytic mode as they were reading that story, you know, in the first couple chapters of Genesis. And you shouldn't be either to begin with. And you shouldn't be that way when you begin with reading the book. Now, we often do get analytical. You know, we notice a little detail. Well, let's see, 6th century BC, almost a 1,000 years. Okay, you know, we're getting precise there. But that's not the first point of the book, to just give us factual historical details like that, for instance. So I hope everyone appreciates that because I've said it so many times. You know, and even if you can't figure out, well, what is the truth in the book, you don't have to answer that question right away. Just know that the words are not the truth. Let that mystery be present as you try to engage the book, as you try to reflect. To recognize that you're seeking something, you're not sure what it is, but it can't be found in a fact-based mode, examining, analyzing the words in the book. Right? It's not something you. It's just like reality. You can't observe it. You can't observe truth. It's something that you have to use your insight to recognize. You get a. You get a. This vague. You know, there's really no word like the Revelator say, but feeling. You know, quote unquote feeling. That there's something present there besides what immediately meets the eye. And then you try to be patiently present with that recognition, and slowly over time you are grown and you actually get your insight improves and your adjuster will actually help to make that grip on that other element more solid. Initially, truth is very tenuous and slips through your fingers, but the spirit ministries will help it to kind of solidify in your recognition. You know, and if you eventually get to that, you experience what Jesus talks about. You know, you feel that you've been set free. You're no longer trapped down in the minutia anymore. You have this piece of objectivity that you never had before. You have the big picture first, and then you can patiently and methodically work with the details in that context. All right, let's keep going here.
This spurious document, reputed to be the teachings of Moses, was brought to the attention of Ptolemy, the Greek king of Egypt, who had it translated into Greek by a commission of 70 scholars for his new library at Alexandria. And so this account found its place among those writings which subsequently became a part of the later collections of the sacred scriptures of the Hebrew and Christian religions. And through identification with these theological systems, such concepts for a long time profoundly influenced the philosophy of many Occidental peoples.
As we all know, it took a long time to recognize the obvious again of evolution. Right? I mean, the ideological bias blinds you to something that ancient people recognized as self-evidently. Right? I mean, a basic human consciousness allows you to recognize evolution. It's like, wow, so think about that. So you get this very definitive ideological bias in play. And effectively what it does is it closes your human eyes. Right? Because to a human, evolution is trivially self-evident, but not to a fancy animal with an ideological bias. It's an important thing to remember about ideology, just how biased everything you experience is if you have the slightest tinge of an ideology as a framework that you use to assimilate. You know, if you assimilate my words, if you assimilate the book's words in the framework of some ideology, right, it doesn't matter how crystal clear what I'm saying appears to be to you, the meaning of what I'm saying or what the book is saying appears to you, that clear observation is false. Yeah, it's very difficult. It's like, no, it's there's no gray area. It's crystal clear, sharp, fuzzy. I mean, this is reality. This is the truth. It's like, no. Error can be just as sharply focused as truth.
Can people develop ideologies regarding evolution and blind themselves to the truth of creation?
Yeah, yeah. All right, it works both ways, obviously. But it's just... again, you know, I mean, that's the thing. It's, you know, it's not, we don't believe in evolution eventually. We believe in Darwinism, or even worse, neo-Darwinism. We believe in an ideology. You know, Darwinism or neo-Darwinism aren't evolution. Those are ideologies. Right? And they're fraught with falsehood. Okay. You know, any more than the Copenhagen interpretation of quantum mechanics, is the fact of quantization. I mean, the physical reality is quantized, but there's a big difference between the fact that it's quantized, and the notions that have been dreamt up predicated on that fact, the isms that have been spawned, relative to that. Yeah. So just, it's a very difficult thing. You know, so many people, for instance, have some political ideology that they've, cemented in their mind over decades, and they're very certain about the interpretation of various experiences that are going on around them. There's almost no appreciation anymore that can, everything you think you've experienced and understood is false. Right, that's supposed to be the point of when you go to college, when you get out of high school and go to college, that's what college is supposed to teach you, that everything that you've thought was true because it was so sharply focused doesn't mean it's true just because it's sharply focused. But see, we don't teach that anymore in college, right? Initially it was just impacting, intellectual, scholarly sorts of spheres with goofy theories. Now it's bled out into the populace at large, and it's becoming almost impossible to find anyone that has any clue that appearance is not reality, for instance, right? And that the way they see the actions of someone might not be really what's going on there. No matter how much it seems it can't be anything else from there, within their frame of mind.
Not to say there aren't facts.
Not to say there aren't facts.
When they talk about what they say here, we well know that while the historical facts and religious truths of this series of revelation presentations will stand on the records of the ages. So some of the facts that we are getting out of here, for me anyway, help me to orient the whole story a lot better.
Sure.
To be able to get to the truth without the facts, it's harder for me to be able to get to the
truth. You can't get to the truth without facts, because truth stems from fact. You have a threefold, right? It's here on the chart. If you look at block number two, fact, truth, goodness. Right? They exist in a triunity. You can't get to the truths of experiential eternity except grounded on objective fact. And that's why the book doesn't just say that it's a revelation of truth. It says it's a revelation of truth and a coordination of essential knowledge, because it's impossible to reveal truth except upon a coordinated foundation of fact. Okay. Yeah. Yep.
Can you show me that chart again? Can you pull it over?
Yeah, I know. For those of you.
What chart is that?
Yeah, so the threefold actuality with unity chart is what I was just pointing to for those on the webinar. And I was just, if you've ever wondered what this is sitting next to me all the time, I take a look at it. Download a copy out of the library at Perfecting Rises Institute and reflect on it a little bit. But there's occasionally it's important to remind yourself of some of those basic structural things that are laid out on that chart, like fact, truth, goodness. And like I was just pointing out, that's different than the beauty, truth, goodness that you see in block number seven on the chart. That's about existential matters. But the experiential issues, right, and that goodness there is not the goodness in beauty, truth, goodness. The goodness that's fact, truth, goodness, that goodness is perfectingness, not perfectness, the existential one. But again, just to focus back. You have to predicate your recognition of truth on a foundation of facts. But see, it's the tricky thing is to approach those facts from the top down instead of the bottom up. You approach the facts from the bottom up and you can't get to truth. you approach them from the top down, initially there's no difference. But eventually there's something in that space above the facts that forms, you form a recognition of truth. See, and that's just the whole point. I mean, you have to, and if you're not observing the facts from the top down, you can never see the truth that's above the facts. If you're only looking at the facts from the bottom up, right, they're opaque and you can't see truth behind them or above them, you know, in the bottom up analogy. Right? I mean, that's, and it's like, well, how could I possibly observe it from the top down? By grace, you're given an encirclement in the Holy Spirit. Right. As an animal, you can't look from the top down. But as a human, if you actually look at it as a human, automatically you're looking at it from the top down. And as a child of God, you won't see the truth. But if you just keep looking at it from the top down, eventually that child of God has grown into an adult of God, and they see the truth that's also there, as well as the facts. Okay, so just, you know, engage the words in the book try to engage them with that human eye, that reflective eye, not just the animal, you know, observing eye. Well, there's an S and there's an I and, you know, that animal eye. Go beyond looking at it like that. Okay, let's see. Meanwhile, back to what we were talking about here. Let's see, did we get everything there? Oh, yeah, okay, that's right. Yeah, the details here of this. Okay, so they're bringing in the whole issue of King Ptolemy here and the library at Alexandria. And what's the name of the Bible that's given a name that literally refers to the fact that there's 70 scholars behind it? Does anyone remember that name I often... mentioned Septuagint. There you go. Yeah, we see it just literally means 70.
That was the giveaway.
Yeah. Yep. Right. That Bible that Jesus got a copy of, the Septuagint. You know, so it's taking those Hebrew texts and translating them into Greek. All right, and you know, you actually have a preservation indirectly in that Greek text of a older Hebrew text, you know, than the literal Hebrew ones that you have subsequently.
I like the word spurious.
Oh, yes, spurious, yeah.
It reminds me of Santa Claus that was called that. Miracle
in 34. Okay, so that's... you know, I mean, even in there, I'll just mention, right, I mean, some scholars wonder if all that's just myth, you know, about the 70 scholars and Ptolemy, and, you know, see, it's all validated right there. Yeah. So every time they give you a little something like that, you may not appreciate that. It's like, oh, yeah, scholars all know that. No, go look. And the scholars will say, well, we don't know for sure. Matter of fact, most of us think that it's probably just a bunch of myths and there's no validity to it. The revelator isn't just a passing, you know, statement can validate little tidbits like that.
Yeah.
There's even questions about, you know, it's like, well, which Ptolemy, you know, was involved in starting the library? Was it the one that was involved in the Septuagint, or was it his father? Well, it says, what does it say right here? For his new library. Not his father's library.
Yeah.
Right? See, every little detail like that, the more you know about the scholarship of things, the more you, oh, they just gave a little hint there, the book is filled with stuff like that.
Yeah.
Right, that normally we don't go into because it just gets kind of too into the weeds. But the more you know about the science, if you will, of any field, the more you can pick up on all kinds of little details like that in the book. Okay.
The Christian teachers perpetuated the belief in the fiat creation of the human race. And all this led directly to the formation of the hypothesis of a one-time golden age of utopian bliss and the theory of the fall of man, or Superman, which accounted for the non-utopian condition of society. These outlooks on life and man's place in the universe were at best discouraging, since they were predicated upon a belief in retrogression rather than progression, as well as implying a vengeful deity who had vented wrath upon the human race in retribution for the errors of certain one-time planetary administrators.
Yeah, see, so just, you know, I mean, obviously they could go on and on and on about the negative consequences, but just in one paragraph to give you a little heads up on that, you know, it all seems to be, well, whatever, 6 1 half does another, you know. What, you know, if they have some made-up story, you know, of a special creation or a made-up story about evolution, you know, like, you know, the story that, well, I think we descended from the hyena, you know, or I think we descended from the parrot, right? you know, what difference does it make? Well, it'd make a huge difference, right? Because it speaks to some basic philosophic framework that you interpret everything within, even if you never even consciously think about the philosophic framework, right? And it just kind of oozes into you once you're born. Right? It colors everything that you do and think, these false philosophic frameworks. And for the first time in human history, it's possible to have a true philosophic framework with the fifth ethical revelation. That's what it's here for. But obviously, you're not going to replace your current false one with this new and improved true one if you aren't even consciously aware of the false one that you have right now. So step one is you to get back and reflect and, oh, I see, everything is in this framework. I never even noticed that framework before. Okay, let's toss that out. Let's insert in the new one. Let's insert in this metaphysics, a true metaphysics, instead of the false one that I unconsciously absorbed throughout my life. That's why you have to do that hard work of reflective thinking and getting to this some rudimentary recognition of the lower hemisphere. That is human philosophy, before you really appreciate what the point of the revelation is. Right? It's the context, you know, in this analogy, under which that all exists. Right? It's the upper hemisphere of the full sphere. So again, that just would remind you that it's, you know, it's not all the little parts that you pour into some frame. Right? It's the frame. Right? Even though it appears to be 2,000 pages of descriptions of parts, it's not the point. Right? Because if you see it that way, obviously, what are you going to do? You're going to take the pile of parts and you're going to pour it in your existent frame, the false one. And every interpretation will be false. Yeah. You won't get the revelation of truth. You'll get your vision of error.
Yeah. I mean, you're pouring a liquid into a false form, and now yeah. The liquid's in that form.
Right. The liquid takes that form, right, that false form. I mean, I know that all sounds abstract, but just try to somehow reflect on the essence of what I'm saying there and see if it, over time, you grow into a recognition, oh, I get what Chris was talking about there. You, it's impossible initially to understand exactly what I'm referring to. You have to, you know, be grown into a recognition of where you begin to see these presently unseen elements of your mind. All right, let's see. Did we get everything there? I think we did. Actually, before I tell you start reading, I should answer that question first. Let's see. We talked about all the basics here already, about the fall of man, essentially. And, just how corrosive, obviously, that is, like they're saying. You know, that, where did they say that? How did they word that? At best discouraging. Right, see? Right? At best, right, it just casts this dark cloud upon your thought that you don't recognize. When times get tough, that little cloud will grow and you'll get depressed and suicidal. It's like, well, everything's going backwards. Hell's going to hell in a handbasket anyway, you know. It's a very insidious seed, you know.
Part and parcel of this is a belief in the end of the world.
Yeah.
The imminent end of the world. And even so-called non-religious people will still get caught up in thinking that everything's moving in that direction to the end of the world.
Yeah.
Which... Well, keep it impossible to have a forward future.
A real future orientation, yeah.
Cessation.
Yeah, yeah. See, think about that. Your seventh adjutant, is just an energy. Is an energy of symmetry. Okay, so therefore, if there was a fiat beginning, symmetrically flip that over. There has to be a fiat ending. Right, because you desire it to be a symmetric picture, so you just, reciprocate it over, so ta-da, you've got Armageddon or whatnot. You've got some fiat ending story.
Yeah. So it's a way to be lazy, for one thing. You could just check out and give up. If there's no hope, why would you bother?
Right. Yeah. Obviously, you get elements of predestination, that everything is really ruled by the fates, if you will, even if you don't actually say fates anymore, you say God. it's a very eviscerating sense of yourself.
Yeah, it's not so much that people give up and give in because they're caught up in their life, and their life does have some meaning to them.
Mm-hmm.
But it prevents them from seeing the bigger picture.
Yeah.
From expanding their worldview from this narrow.
Yeah.
Their narrow one to a more encompassing one.
Yeah, exactly. Just like I've said several times in different contexts, that's the whole. There's all these insidious things that actually short circuit your human potential, and you don't recognize they're doing that. Right? They cram you down into a small space so that you just can't see the big picture, and until you choose to not be self-limited like that, no matter how much you look for the big picture, you won't find it, because it's not to be found down in that little thimble you've stuffed yourself in, that ideological thimble you've stuffed yourself into.
Average discouragement. Mm. At best, it's discouraging. It's down
yet. Yeah, right.
It's really sucky.
Yeah, right. Yeah, see, that's why I wanted to find where it wasn't just highlight that, just to notice that at best, discouraging. It's like, well, discouraging is not a great best, is it? Yeah. And it gets worse from there, folks. Right, yeah. Yeah. Right. There's going to be a few strong individuals that will be merely discouraged. And everyone else is going to be worse.
Yeah.
See?
Yeah. The best case.
So how are you going to get to courageous and independent cosmic thinking if your starting point is discouragement? See?
So Moses started this, and what was his best case scenario?
Well, they pointed out it's... Moses didn't plan all of this. Way after Moses, they brought in this other story that seemed to be suggesting that the beginning of everything is also at the same time as Adam. And they were trying to make that point that it's not Moses' fault that it got all muddled up like this. Yeah.
So we can't point a finger
here. No.
Let's start off with the Christian teachers.
Yeah.
Story.
Yeah.
In that
Yeah, it's just, Moses, I'm sure, looks back and is like, seriously, that's what you did with that story, so. That's the basic point they're trying to make, is that you don't blame Moses. Okay.
The quote-unquote golden age is a myth, but Eden was a fact, and the garden civilization was actually overthrown. Adam and Eve carried on in the garden for 117 years when, through the impatience of Eve and the errors of judgment of Adam, they presumed to turn aside from the ordained way, speedily bringing disaster upon themselves and ruinous retardation upon the developmental progression of all Urantia. Narrated by Salonia, the seraphic voice in the garden.
Oh, what a happy note to end on. Speedily bringing disaster.
Ruinous retardation.
And remember, when they use the word disaster, right, they're wanting you to remember the literalness. You know, that means literally apart from the stars.
Oh, yeah.
Right? There's a literalness of that. You know, take the truth of that. Not the fact of it, you know. The literal fact, but the truth of that. In other words, you're severing your synchronization with the cosmos.
Yeah.
Right. But yeah. See. So you know. Obviously, by the time they end here, they get back to the story at hand. But you know, let's just continue with the myth elements. Right. We all know how powerful the golden age concept is. You know, we've already talked about it, and just mentioning Eden, if we could only go back to Eden, back to the golden age. All right, we have all these fantasies like that. Then the other fascinating little element that they threw in, a specific thing, 117 years. I mentioned that this was coming up, so here it is. Here's actually the time from the arrival till the default is 117 years. So the first thing we can think about with that, besides, you got this time horizon of 100 years, and if it doesn't happen in 100 years, everyone just gives up or doesn't think it's relevant. There's that, even though they're material sons and daughters. But remember, they told us that there were 63 children, right, from prior to the default. And we were looking back then, and it certainly appeared that the first five were like crammed together just about as tight as you can make them to fit into the 7 years before the Melchizedek's left. You know, so that we had, you have 9 months from conception and then nursing for a year, and then boom, getting pregnant again and 9 months until birth, and nursing for a year, and having we have these sets of four, and the second and third are twins in the set of four. Remember, we were thinking about all that. And we're wondering, it's like, well, okay, with those 63, does she keep up that pace where it's just not a breath of break, just boom, 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 all the way? Well, now we know it's 117 years, so you do a little math. It's like, oh, no, if she was kept up the breakneck pace with no breaks between kids, effectively, it wouldn't have taken 117 years.
Right.
Yeah, matter of fact, if you play with the math a little bit, on average, she could have taken 9 months between stopping nursing and getting pregnant again. You know, she could have put on average a 9-month gap between every,
she may not have been 9 months, we don't know.
Well, there's also that issue. We have to kind of just assume that, it took 9 months before from conception to birth. But, we're making assumptions, yes. But anyway, as a matter of fact, you could even 117 years, if she did it without any breaks and you didn't have any twins, if you assume there was no twins, she still wouldn't span 117 years. Okay, so that's an interesting little tidbit. So that she wasn't just nothing but, a woman, a milk truck. Okay, I mean, this says that there's some, there's some greater complexity to what she's doing. She's obviously spending a lot of time, kind of more, in a material son. Just like Adam, mode, right, and not just serving as the baby factory.
Yeah.
Okay.
And then their system experience isn't anything like that kind of density.
Yeah, right, like we pointed out. I mean, you know, they were living for a long, long, long time, and they only had 100 kids.
Yeah.
You know what gets me is that I got a bunch of friends who, you know, they go to church every Sunday. And they, this whole story of the creation in 7 days, and, I mean, it's the Word of God.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like, and, you know, they're smart people.
Yeah.
And yet they're still, I don't know what it's fear or what it is that captures them into that whole thing of, well, John, you know, what you're telling me can't be true.
Mm-hmm.
And when I say, well, doesn't it make a little bit more sense? The Adam and Eve story never really made sense to me when I was, you know, growing up as a Christian. So when I read the story here, it was like, oh, boy, this is, I got this one. This makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
This is one of those stories that, for people today who take every single word of the Bible as the, you know, how they do it, the Word of God, and they hold it up and they walk down the aisle and, in the gospel. And, you know, you were talking about that earlier in terms of at what point does that, you know, you don't want to usurp their faith, you know what I mean? They'll figure they're going to get it eventually because, you know, that's what holds their faith together. Mm-hmm. I think if you, how should we say it, if you somehow punch holes into, you know, that faith that they have now, which is basically grounded in their beliefs, you know, you're not really doing them any good.
Yeah.
To some extent, though, the book does say that what Jesus did with that case was he would point out some truths and let those truths work their way through their
right.
life, which I guess you can do.
Yeah, see, and
good at it.
And think about what I was talking about earlier, how ironic it is that this whole issue of the Word of God, that, you know, they say that, and they may even be an individual that has, you know, at best a disinterest in science. They might even, you know, have, you know, be aggressively, you know, think of scientists in very negative terms, right? Scientists as enemies. See, they don't recognize that they're reading the Bible after the Enlightenment. They're reading the Bible in a society that has a basic concept of facts and knowledge, right, as part of the culture. And so when they say it's the Word of God, they're saying that with this fact bias. See, it would be better if it would be better, you know, if they want to be so tied to just that framework, if they could go back to these people they were referring to earlier that aren't so fixated on it factually, that innocently, as a child of God, will engage the truth of it that's there. You know, so that when they say it's the Word of God, what they mean by that is that the voice of God is the voice of truth, and in that sense, it's the Word of God. But see, they don't even recognize what they mean by that is that the voice of God is the voice of fact, and this is the Word of God in that sense.
But they're very religious in their belief, in their
Of course, and but again,
being told. Atheistic about it.
Yeah. See, and that's the big difference between the fourth epical revelation, engaging them in a fourth epical mode, where you don't worry about their fact, you know, the worldview that they have that they interpret everything in. You're just trying to get them to get a firm hold on the ideal of God, right? His infinite and eternal nature. So the fifth epical revelation is, you know, going way beyond that, right? And, you shouldn't be engaging him in a fifth epical mode. The people you should be engaging in a fifth epical mode are a select few that have the essence of the fourth.
Some of the truths you can...
And are ready to...
You know,
Yeah.
The child, you know, being, a lot of people don't even believe they have the right to be a son of God.
Sure. You know, yeah.
So, yeah. But they do get off on the father part of God. I think that, you know, it seems that that's okay. But then the corollary that.
But again, you know, we know from the revelation here that, you know, God was being presented as the Father way, way, way back. You don't even, you know, that's way pre-fourth epical revelation. That goes all the way back to the first epical revelation.
So that's easy to.
All right. So, yeah, those things, I mean, the book, the Urantia book can remind you of what basic elements you could try to reinforce in fourth, fifth, you know. I mean, in first, second, third, fourth, epical revelation modes.
Oh, that's what you have to do.
Yeah, for most people, you know, if you feel like they could use a little fostering from you, right? You know, if it feels like their grip is a little tentative, and you'd like to help them a little bit, you don't want to see them fall. You know, help them in the appropriate mode. But, you know, when it comes to the rugged truths in here, right, you know, you're looking for a very small number of individuals, you know, that are ready to take that on. Yeah.
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 I've seen where, you know, trying to communicate with people who aren't familiar with the Urantia book and doing it in a somewhat meaningful or real way. And struggling with, well, why do they misconstrue
mm-hmm. the thing I said? Yeah.
Well, see, we're comfortable and accustomed to thinking in the ideas.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And when you, especially if you're in any way critical of they take it directly to their ideals, and they feel like you're trying to take their ideals away from them.
Yeah.
And that's where what we need to do is discern, not, you know, gently bring up the ideas, but you have to understand they're not necessarily that interested. The ideas.
Yeah.
But they're very tenaciously trying to hold on to their ideals.
Yes.
And we need to be careful not to.
Yes. Remember the Urantia book talks.
To wrench their ideals away from them.
Remember what the Urantia book says directly about trying to wrench away, you know, the initial tentative relationship to ideals in a child. Right.
That's a millstone.
Yeah, it's not. You know, you shouldn't be. But yeah, see, that's a great point. Just. You know, for those on the webinar, I'll give you the essence of that. I mean, you know, just the book, you know, as I pointed out, from first paragraph to final sentence, it's about the idea, not the ideal. Right? And if you try to give someone what you recognize as a better idea of God, they won't take it that way. Like you were just saying, to them it will seem that you're trying to rip away their relationship to the ideal of God. I mean, so that's the thing. You have to recognize when you've got someone who has actually, even if they haven't consciously thought about it, have separated idea from ideal, and have a firm hold on the ideal, and are ready. They don't recognize it, but they're ready to take an eraser to the whole idea part. And when you show them a way that they can erase it and start fresh, they will be so excited. It's like, I never imagined that I could live in a time when I could erase all this silly idea stuff and put something solid in its place.
You have to be ready for that.
I was ready for that. It's the coolest thing ever, right? Because I had already, without consciously, you know, saying it to myself, I had already separated idea from ideal, and I had a firm hold of the ideal. So nothing I was reading threatened it one iota.
Took a while to understand it.
Sure. Took years and years. Yeah. Took 10 years before anything significant started to sink in. Right? And, all right. Let's see if we can read a little bit here at the beginning of paper 75. Yeah, they were just hinting at, what about the default?
Paper 75, the default of Adam and Eve. After more than 100 years of effort on Urantia, Adam was able to see very little progress outside the garden. The world at large did not seem to be improving much. The realization of race betterment appeared to be a long way off, and the situation seemed so desperate as to demand something for relief not embraced in the original plans. At least that is what often passed through Adam's mind, and he so expressed himself many times to Eve. Adam and his mate were loyal, but they were isolated from their kind, and they were sorely distressed by the sorry plight of their world.
So that's very important. See, that put as a preface. I think everyone probably recognizes it. Right, we're about to read some stuff where you can start to come down pretty hard on Eve. Okay, no, this is a coordinate pair.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Just like they just said in the last paragraph. And the errors of judgment of Adam.
Right. You know. They cited both.
And I was going to ask you what those were.
Right. They both got hammered.
Those ideas going through his mind, she was hearing them.
Right. I mean, see. Right.
Yeah,
see,
she was trying to say, okay.
And even though when they were talking, even they're talking, it's all conscious and consciously, you know, both of them are saying, yeah, but, you know, we definitely are not going to do anything, you know, that's not, how did they word that? Embraced in the original plans?
Yeah.
Adam has just put an unconscious frame of reference in her mind. She's not aware it's there. But all of the thoughts begin to occur within that frame. So completely unwittingly, the next thing she knows, she's built a whole structure inside that false frame and acts upon it. It's that. See, that's exactly what I was just talking about before. So you recognize that. Think about how many things have gotten into your head, like these words from Adam have got into Eve's head over the last however many decades of your life. Your head is full of false frames like that. You have no idea that they're coloring everything you think and do.
Not only that, you probably do those to others.
You know? Yeah, and you've been the Adam whispering in someone's ear many times. So, you know.
You don't have to do it too many times. Even once, somebody who wants to.
Should sober you. It's like, you know, maybe I should keep my mouth shut most of the time because I might be, you know, seeding someone with something that shouldn't be there. It's not my desire, but. Yeah.
There's either.
Yeah. It's just, that's a great example of what I was talking about before.
Yeah. It's a difference, I think, mm-hmm. in terms of.
Yeah. And I've told you, I take this very seriously myself. I talk a lot about the revelation, you may have noticed. I say a lot of things. Okay. I take that very seriously. Right? I try my best to not say something that's going to put a false frame in your mind. I mean, I can't do anything about the false frames you already have, but I try my best not to make the situation worse. You know, if I have any hesitation about my interpretation of stuff, you're never going to hear me say anything about it. You have no idea I've ever even thought about those things. Okay? You know, I don't presume to speak for the revelation. I've assumed the responsibility to speak as humbly and precisely and truthfully as I can. Because I know how problematic this is. I know how much reverence you probably have for this book. How seriously you take things about this book. How much, if I speak falsely, how much you could turn that into concrete in your mind and how it could lead you astray.
Well, dear, we're just not getting it.
Okay. So,
look around us. What are we doing wrong?
I mean, I'm obviously not perfect, but I'm trying my best to not be this unfortunate voice of Adam in Eve's ear.
That's a good lesson.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, a little bit more here.
Section 1, the Urantia Problem. The Adamic mission on experimental, rebellion-seared, and isolated Urantia was a formidable undertaking. And the material son and daughter early became aware of the difficulty and complexity of their planetary assignment. Nevertheless, they courageously set about the task of solving their manifold problems. But when they addressed themselves to the all-important work of eliminating the defectives and degenerates from among the human strains, they were quite dismayed. They could see no way out of the dilemma, and they could not take counsel with their superiors on either Gerasim or Edentia. Here they were, isolated and day by day confronted with some new and complicated tangle, some problem that seemed to be unsolvable.
As you're reading that, one thought you might have is like, well, I mean, yeah, but they could send a message back and forth, you know, for the angels between here and Gerasim. Yeah, but they give you the answer to that at the end. Day by day, confronted with some new and complicated tangle.
Yeah.
Okay.
They didn't have that.
It's a 5-year journey one way. Okay, to Gerasim. Right. I mean, they need to be on the walkie-talkie every 10 seconds.
Yeah.
You know, with some help.
They need bandwidth.
Okay. Right. Yeah, so...
True, but Van and Amidon lasted for, 150,000 years?
Yeah, but Van and Amidon knew that we weren't trying to take on the job. Okay, so now how do we handle the degenerates and the...
Slow.
Right, I mean, they were just being hands-off on most of those big issues. Right? But Adam and Eve, no, it's like, no, we can't just sit here... and be station keeping like Van and Amidon. We've got to take on these tasks, and it looked impossible. And you notice we've got it there, defectives and degenerates. Or degenerate is the second word. I mean, that vertical problem, that's the foundational problem. But there's also the horizontal defective issue as well.
Even today. I mean, we still have some of these problems left here.
We have all these problems still.
Multiply.
In some of them, we have them worse now. Because
we're a little bit more.
Because if you don't eliminate the defectives and the degenerates, right? There's a thing called procreation that tends to exponentially propagate it forward into the future.
Did they say what they were supposed to have done? To eliminate the
defective. See, you see between the lines there that normally a fully functioning prince and his staff, right? They don't really get into blending the races and stuff, but they do work on fostering at least the attrition of the defectives and generates. So when Adam and Eve come, it's fairly cleaned out, and they can work more directly on just bringing it together in a coordinated fashion. And now all of these millennia have gone by, and they're looking at it. It's like I was saying, it's not a big problem when you have a handful of people, that are defective or degenerate, but you propagate it forward through endless generations.
Yeah.
Family trees tend to flare out as you go down from the top of it, right? I mean, this is a geometric problem here.
They saw it. It's not just staying the same. It's way worse than when we got here.
Early on, it's an arithmetic problem, okay? But now they're looking at this geometric problem, and they're thinking, I mean...
Are you kidding me?
You can solve an arithmetic problem with arithmetic methods.
Right.
How do you solve a geometric problem with arithmetic methods? It seems impossible. Yeah.
But first of all, I'm not necessarily... They knew this ahead of time. They were told this was going to be the situation. They had a plan, and the plan to solve this, which would have been much longer, obviously was to have, half a million or a million of their own created, which they did the math on that. They realized that was going to take a long time to begin with.
When you're on high...
Slowly... Yeah.
I'm
not on high.
Yeah, but again, when they're on high, it's like, okay, theoretically, I got it. Yeah, it's all going to work. But you actually get down in the trenches.
Experiences.
When you actually, they're engaged, they're going to mention this. You have emotions, for instance, right? When you're face to face, right? That those emotions pull you down. They're, you know, they're going to mention that. They're being pulled down by material gravity. It's hard to stay up there and objective and keep going, right? Yeah. That's what they're going to mention. See, it's just the enormity of it, the material gravity of it is pulling them down, tugging on their emotions, getting them more and more biased to their, you know, their idealistic consciousness and, you know, wishing there was some way they could snap their fingers and stop all the suffering.
Right. Right. They have no context of that.
No difference.
See, that's the thing. You see, in very short order, they're just like us.
Yeah.
They've lost all their objectivity of Gerasim. They're just like us with our spiritual consciousness being tugged by our emotional responses. And it goes, exactly how it would play out with us plays out with them.
Barely above a little bit of objectivity is accused of being lacking.
They're heartless.
Yeah, but yeah. There's compassion.
Yeah.
This person has no compassion. Yeah. How could he say that if he had compassion?
Yeah, anyway, so, yeah, I mean, that's, that. You've already got, you know, the gist that you can get from there about. It's like, wait a minute, this reminds me a lot of what's going on today, might even what's going on in my head. Right? You know.
Under normal conditions, the first work of a planetary Adam and Eve would be the coordination and blending of the races. But on Urantius, such a project seemed just about hopeless, for the races, while biologically fit, had never been purged of their retarded and defective strains.
So again, see, that, like I said, I mean, see, there, the key thing there is just the first work, see. You know, so they're not, it's like, well, we can't do step one. So now what? Do you got something there?
Well, what is the difference between biologically fit?
Oh.
How can you be biologically fit and still be retarded and defective?
Just, there's nothing innately wrong with the stock. You have the outlier elements. I mean, you know, you've got a bell curve, right? And normally, you know, the tails get chopped off so that you've got the solid core. You know, there's a solid core. It's just that you need to at least prevent the tails from, you know, procreating so much, so that you tighten it up. Yeah. All right.
Adam and Eve found themselves on a sphere wholly unprepared for the proclamation of the brotherhood of man, a world groping about in abject spiritual darkness and cursed with confusion, worse confounded by the miscarriage of the mission of the preceding administration. Mind and morals were at a low level, and instead of beginning the task of effecting religious unity, they must begin all anew the work of converting the inhabitants to the most simple forms of religious belief. Instead of finding one language ready for adoption, they were confronted by the worldwide confusion of hundreds upon hundreds of local dialects. No atom of the planetary service was ever set down on a more difficult world. The obstacles seemed insuperable, and the problems beyond creature solution.
Okay, did you notice some things like, wait a minute, yeah, I mean, that's what I want to do. I'm prepared for the proclamation of the brotherhood of man. That's what I see as my mission. You know, and affecting religious unity. See, look how, see, this is not a story of the past. This is a story of the present.
Yeah.
Okay. The difference is Adam and Eve were still facing facts, and that's why they were, you know, getting a more and more hopeless sense about things. Right? We have all these people who want to proclaim the brotherhood of man and affect religious unity that are clueless of the facts.
Yeah.
Right?
These guys do better.
Right.
But we don't.
Yeah. Right. Those who who yearn to proclaim the brotherhood of man today, do they know that they live in a world that's groping about in abject spiritual darkness and cursed with confusion, worse confounded by the miscarriage of the mission of the preceding administration? Do they know that? No. They don't even want to hear those words. Those are icky.
Yeah. We're the only planet.
Now you got to face facts and adjust them to ideals in order to achieve wisdom. Right.
If you suggest that there are people who are debased, you are a racist.
Yeah, try using the word degenerate or retarded.
No.
I mean, let alone defective.
Well, there's no reason to bash people in the face with using those words.
No. But see, again, that's the whole point is this is not a dispensational revelation. You're not supposed to go out preaching the good news of defectives and degenerates. No. See? This is for a few who are ready to face those facts. Right? You still want to eventually have the brotherhood of man proclaimed on this planet, but you know that you're not going to do it tomorrow. You need to be working in the long game that Adam and Eve are supposed to be working in. Right? Step one is not blending the races.
No kidding.
No. Many steps need to be done before that. And the delight in trying to preserve every dialect and, you know, even reawakening now dead tongues, you know, that those same people that want the religious unity, affecting religious unity, want to do. No, that's against your desires. Let the dead ones be dead and recognize that a lot more need to die.
We would bring back extinct animals if we could.
There's a reason why they're extinct. Yes, don't bring them back.
There's funding for a real Jurassic Park. Someone's got the right amber.
Just all the things, see, that are between the lines. Like how it's, see, that's the truth that's flowing through it. It's exactly, you know, the fact that we don't know this stuff today is why this book is in my lap. Right, why there's this emergency. All of these zealous people who don't face facts that are just blowing up the whole evolutionary state of affairs.
A lot of people don't have the facts to face, even if they are looking for them.
Yeah, and that's another problem. I mean, it's harder and harder to go to any institution of so-called higher learning and get, you know, a potential relationship to the facts. I see everything is just falling apart. Okay.
They were isolated, and the tremendous sense of loneliness which bore down upon them was all the more heightened by the early departure of the Melchizedek receivers. Only indirectly, by means of the angelic orders, could they communicate with any being off the planet. Slowly their courage weakened, their spirits drooped, and sometimes their faith almost faltered.
They drooped. Material gravity is dragging them down. We talked about the discouraged thing. See, their courage is weakening. Maybe you don't say discouraged yet. They're not totally apart from courage, but they're getting there. Then the literal spirits drooped. I mean, look, picture it in the hourglass analogy, right? The spiritualized mind is only in the upper domain, right? Faith is only in the upper domain. Right, they're being drugged down into the lower domain, the domain of feelings, these intense feelings they're feeling for these poor, desperate people. It's dragging them down. That's what drags every budding child. Those feelings do that to every child of God that has a bit of spiritual consciousness. You think the feelings are your spiritual consciousness. No, they're the enemy of your spiritual consciousness. It's going to drag you down. Feelings are material consciousness. And it's very difficult. When they say faith almost faltered, I mean, they're talking about genuine faith here.
almost face your feelings.
They're hanging on by one fingernail to the sixth level of meaning. They're about to just be totally pulled down. Okay.
And this is the true picture of the consternation of these two noble souls as they pondered the task which confronted them. They were both keenly aware of the enormous undertaking involved in the execution of their planetary assignment.
Yeah, so I mean, they're just stressing. They're aware, but you know, the objectivity that has to go with that awareness, you know, they're losing that. All of this is kind of just a preface. You know, they're trying to make sure that when you read what follows this section, you have some hope of interpreting it truthfully, because it's fraught with the potential of misinterpretation.
Don't forget, they say noble souls.
Yeah.
Keep that in mind the whole time.
Yeah. See, two noble souls. And they never fundamentally lose that. It's never rebellion. It's just a fault. But again, you're a noble soul. But you can follow this same path.
Probably no material sons of Nebadon were ever faced with such a difficult and seemingly hopeless task as confronted Adam and Eve in the sorry plight of Urantia. But they would have sometime met with success had they been more far-seeing and patient. Both of them, especially Eve, were altogether too impatient. They were not willing to settle down to the long, long endurance test. They wanted to see some immediate results, and they did, but the results thus secured proved most disastrous both to themselves and to their world.
What do we want? Results. When do we want it? Now. No patience. For those who are just listening, the word patient there is italicized. And there you see the far-seeing, right? That human, that individual of the future, right? They're losing, their relationship to the future. They're getting pulled down into the moment. All these things, and just why is the word patient italicized there? It's not just because fundamentally default is self-righteous impatience. Again, in the hourglass analogy, it's right there. What is the neck of the hourglass? The level of patience, right? If you are impatient, if you drop down below the level of patience, right, you're out of the upper domain. Right? There isn't anything in the upper domain that isn't predicated on patience. That's the foundation of your whole relationship to the cosmos. Right? That's why it's such a poison, that thing I always say, what do we want? Fill in the blank. When do we want it? Now. That's spirit poison. Right? See, it's fundamentally impatient. That's the thought of a fancy animal, not a human. It's so unfortunate to approach everything in your life that way, like a lot of people do.
They were two of, I forget how many, thousands, wasn't it, of material sons and daughters who volunteered for this
program. Yeah. They all those senior ones volunteered.
That's the best choice.
Yeah.
So we really have no reason to believe anyone else would have been more likely to succeed.
Mm-hmm.
Which, at least me, contemplate, well, were they... No, they're really not constituted for the challenge that was faced. They were facing. It seems unfair, I have the sense that it's unfair. Yeah. But even set that aside, it seems like it was almost foreordained that they would fail.
Right. Again,
foreknown.
Highly probable that they would fail, but. Again, did they change the normal order of things because of that? It's like, well, because any Adam and Eve would fail, let's not do an Adam and Eve. Let's do something. No, that would be rebellion right there. Right?
it had to be done.
Right, it's part of the process that must be. I mean, okay. Right, and when all is said and done, it's like, well, despite the default and stuff, yeah, we still got some Adamic blood, and when all is said and done, it's going to be turn out to be just enough so that you can get forward to, you know, everything is going to work out fine in the end.
All the more glorious.
But it wouldn't have if they said, well, let's just skip Adam and Eve on this planet, and, yeah. Well, yep.
So two things. One is it reminds me of how often Jesus said, my hour has not come, and how he wasn't tempted as a creator son to make things right by fiat.
By fiat, yeah.
And that's kind of an interesting, shows you how incredibly wonderful personality Michael is.
Yeah, that his revelation was evolutional. See, every revelation has to be evolutional.
Yeah, especially. And the other is that, you know, probably no material son of Nebadon was ever faced with this. It harkens me back to that, you know, life on a neighboring planet where maybe the material son came to that one country, you know, and everything. But they may not have had as tough a time. Of course, the races were a little bit different maybe in that one country. But,
yeah.
But when you think about that, I mean, it's almost an honor to come from this, the worst place in the universe, and be able to, you know, be given a revelation without a guidebook, you know, and figure out, you know, for us to be able to sit here and through using our intelligence and so on and so forth and our prayers and, you know, and the spirit within us to try and do something we believe is the right thing to do. And yet at the same time, as, you know, you say many times, have that patience and have that understanding and use your wisdom to do what you can do on the evolutionary side of things and not the revolution. I call it, instead of being a revolutionist, I'm a revelationist.
Uh-huh.
Now, but, you know, that kind of thing. And it's not, it's tricky.
No, it's very, very tricky. Yeah. Yeah, you know, so.
In the end, it's kind of what they also say is that in the end, it's going to work out.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's stuff. It's going to be one way or another. I mean, it's
going to work out better than ever.
Yeah,
it's more glorious because of that than it might have been.
And again, just, you know, remember, how do you fundamentally turn this whole story on its head? Right, you know, if in this sense, we are the least in actuality, then in this sense, we are the greatest in potentiality. You were born on the greatest world, right? And in that potentiality is value. There's more value in play here than on a normal world. The potential is greater. You know, so, you know, see it in that positive mode. See it in that human, with that human insight. As a fancy animal, you should hate being born on this world, but as a human, you should delight. You were born on a world with more potentiality than almost any other world imaginable. The things that you can do here that you can't do anywhere else. Right? If you could just find the courage to act. Right?
And you gotta have a little wisdom.
Yeah, right. Right, of course.
And the thought of contributing to the Supreme is kind of beautiful.
Yes, yeah.
If we do.
How trusting it is to say, I'm going to contribute to the Supreme. You don't know exactly what you're talking about, but you know it's going to be cool. And so you're going to do it.
Yeah, like whether we ever know we did it or not,
right.
We know that that is happening somehow.
Yeah. To act in that with that trust like that, that soul trust, transcendent of mere spiritual faith. Okay, so, you know, again, it's just, you know, this is speaking to us. We all need to be willing to settle down to the long, long endurance test. Right? If you want to do something for this world, it has to be predicated on that consciousness. You know, pour some water on your head and put out the flaming hair. Right? And you can't be running around with your hair on fire. Because you're going to secure results, but they're going to prove to be disastrous, right? both to yourself and to the world.
Pour some water on
it. Right? We're all got so many people running around with their hair on fire.
Step away from the flammable hair product.
How do they say that? Pour some water in your head and put
extinguish the fire in your head.
Yeah.
Oh, well, there goes.
Okay, anyway.
Gotta go to the archive now.
All right, so so we'll just, you know, it's getting really late here, so we need to wrap it up. But but you know, I hope you got the basic sense there. And I said it's getting really late, and that reminded me there was one other thing I want to say there. Such a difficult and seemingly hopeless task. Yeah, it appeared to be hopeless, but it wasn't really. See, and again, the animal, you know, can't know that. Right? Only the human, which they were losing their grip on, can know the reality is, you know, of it, that it's not really hopeless.
They became natural creatures,
yeah,
in a sense, right, just enough to pull them out of contention.
See, and when all is said and done, because they ended up being so much like us, their story is all that more relevant to us. If they hadn't fallen like this, their story would not be that helpful to us. But because they're so much like us, their story is very relevant. We can learn a lot from their story.
Can I just say one other thing? I have kind of an attitude about immigration and refugees and that kind of thing, and like just keep them there. But if we were among them and had to see it in our everyday life, we would have the same kind of feelings that they had. Like, you would get brought down by it.
Yeah.
Unless you are an automaton, I think. You couldn't have like these platitude feeling.
Yeah, it's very difficult to not be pulled down by your emotions. Okay, let's take a moment here, everyone.